get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas. We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. With the recent success of the film Superbad, it's the perfect time to examine the genre of teen movies. When did teen films as we think of them today start to take off? How have the themes expressed in teen movies been impacted by shifting societal concerns? And what are some of the landmark works of the genre? My guest is Tim Sherry, director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma, and author of Generation Multiplex, which examines the subject of American teenagers in cinema. Part one of our conversation is up next on Under Surveillance. Welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance on WLUW. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show, I'm happy to be joined by Tim Sherry. Tim is the director of Film and Video Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Generation Multiplex, a book which examines the topic of American teenagers in cinema. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Well, thanks for having me, Kevin.
We're talking about teen movies today, and Tim, I certainly want to get your thoughts on the current teen comedy hit Superbad in a few minutes, but I want to first take a look at the origins of what we now call the teen film genre. Is this something that emerged with Cameron Crowe's Fast Times at Ridgemont High and the John Hughes films of the 1980s, such as Ferris Bueller's Day Off, or had it existed prior to that time period?
Well, overall, I would argue that it existed prior to the 80s, certainly. It's just that it seems to be reborn every decade and in a new guise. Sometimes that guise is of a sexual nature, young people looking for, boyfriends and girlfriends, and young people looking to score, as they say. And sometimes that guise is one of delinquency and one of danger. And I think if you look at it from that angle, you can certainly see it emerging in the 1950s with Rebel Without a Cause and Blackboard Jungle and other films about criminal youth, rock and roll, and so on. And yet not all those films were necessarily about criminality. They were overall about rebellion. There were very few films in the 50s that were, in any explicit way at least, about sexuality. The sexual aspect of teen films really seemed to emerge more prominently in the 60s, and that held on for a while, and then it faded for a while as the 70s teen films seemed to occupy themselves more with themes around horror and danger, and then it went back to the sexual themes that you just mentioned in terms of Fast Times. So I think that the teen film's really been quite prominent since at least the 50s, and there's some examples of it even going back to the 30s and 40s.
I think in your book, Generation Multiplex, you talked about how the advent of the shopping mall was something that was really crucial to the development of teen films.
Yes. And what the shopping mall did in the 70s and 80s was concentrate the location of the screens of American movies. For the most part, before the 70s at least, there were single-screen theaters, there were drive-ins, and people would often plan to go to a movie based on what was playing at a single movie theater. When you go into the 70s, and it's not as if the first multi-screen theater started in the 70s, I think they actually started in the 50s, but they didn't become really prominent until the 70s. And then you began giving people in general, and especially young people, more options for what they wanted to see at a theater site. 3, 4, 5 movies you could choose between. And they all often had starting times, usually within the same hour. And that became a way of catering to what became known as the television market, the market of people who'd gotten used to seeing television shows roughly every hour or so, if not every half hour. And that also made a really profound connection with young people who themselves wanted to go out of their house, away from their family, and wanted to have a variety of themes and genres to choose from. So you had your comedies, you had your horror films, some action, maybe some mysteries. And that, I think, served the market really well because they were quite concerned by the late 70s with the rise of cable television and home video that they would lose their market.
Talking about television, has there been a significant, cause and effect in terms of popular television shows featuring teens versus those themes, I suppose, in cinema? You know, I'm just thinking of, 70s, Happy Days was a huge hit.
Gary Marshall, who created Happy Days, said quite early on that the reason that he set the show in the 50s was because he knew that if he had set it in the contemporary early 70s, he'd have to deal with drugs and sex in order to talk about current teen realities, and he knew that he couldn't get away with that with the television censors. So he set it back in the 50s, only about 20 years earlier, really only about 15 years earlier, in this somewhat mythical time when kids were supposedly just discovering sexuality. There were no drugs. Even Fonzie was only able to be a hood because he rode a motorcycle and wore a leather jacket. And the censors were very sensitive with how that would get disseminated. And the movies, on the other hand, didn't have the same kind of prohibitions. Movies had the R rating. They could make movies about teenagers engaged in acts of violence or sex, using foul language and so on. And that really gave filmmakers an opportunity to explore what I would say was in many ways a more realistic side of the teen experience. Because after all, even Happy Days is not a realistic portrayal of
sure.
what teenagers in the 50s were like.
Yeah, but even TV comedies in the 80s, you had Family Ties, you had the Bill Cosby Show, those types of programs that portrayed kids in school that where you certainly didn't get into issues like drugs and sex.
Well, if they did, it was tangentially. It was a friend of mm-hmm. one of the main characters or something. And I think that television has really tried to serve the interest of middle America and especially parents, because most successful long-term shows that have teenagers on them tend to really focus on the parents. The Cosby Show and Family Ties are prime examples of that. They're not really focused on the teens. The teens are prominent, but the parents are very smart. They're well off. They're very sagacious, and they have this sense of wisdom that their kids tend to follow. And these shows don't tend to be about the teenagers themselves deciding whether they should have sex or not at the age of 15, or should they try certain drugs before high school or before college and so on. And we got a little bit of that more so in the 90s, I would say, with shows like Beverly Hills 90210 and to some degree Melrose Place, which was older, older young people.
That 70s show, I think, that's something that they really touched on those themes.
You're absolutely right, and yet the fascinating thing about that 70s show is that it's a 20-year reflection, if not more like 25, 30-year reflection on what it was like. And so that seems safe, apparently, to the television networks, because it's as if they're saying, well, teenagers today don't act this way anymore, they don't behave this way. And the funny thing is that they're so much more involved with drugs and so much less involved with sex than they tend to be in American movies today. In American movies today, teenagers are very little, well, I shouldn't say very little, they're not involved in violence at all, for the most part. They're only slightly involved with drugs, but they're much more involved with sex. And I find that a curious distinction. Ever since Columbine in 99, the studios just don't want to deal with teen violence. And it's very striking, even though teen violence is something that still obviously occurs.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of, in terms of teen violence in film, I'm thinking a lot about the films that came out in the 90s, where you had films like Boys in the Hood and films
sure.
like...
Juice.
Oh, Juice, yeah. But a lot of their inner-city gang life, basically,
right.
and often featuring African-American communities.
Exactly. Those films hinged on and took advantage of, if not exploited, a racial tension in America at the time, especially in the wake of the Rodney King situation, and then later O.J., where Americans were told there's this trouble out there in our cities, and it hinges on white versus black tensions. The fact of the matter was the crime rate was actually declining, and it's been declining ever since the early 90s. In a few categories, it has gone up. But films about teenagers involved in crime were really quite popular throughout the early and mid-90s, as if there was some kind of teenage crime wave going on. In fact, it was not the case, and yet it made for good box office. Hollywood is first and foremost a business. It wants to make money and is going to try to exploit and tap into any way of doing that. And it did for a while, and then it faded away when apparently the audiences just weren't showing up anymore. It was the same with teen sex comedies. Teen sex comedies were doing very well at the box office through the early 80s, and then the specter of AIDS came along, and it didn't become very appealing anymore to make jokes about premarital or promiscuous sex among young people and how they might work out or might not and might get diseases and so on. It just wasn't funny anymore. And so Hollywood avoided teen sex comedies altogether after around 1986.
And now you have a current film like Superbad that is focused almost primarily on sex.
Now, it's funny you should say that. I think that the marketing of it is primarily focused around sex. But remarkably, in this film, none of the characters has much of a sexual experience at all. The three main characters, Seth, Evan, and McLovin, as they call him, they all pursue sex. They all have their kind of convoluted and confused ways of going about it, but none of them so much as barely kisses a girl. And I find now McLovin, it seems, might actually be having sex with his so-called conquest, but even that's broken up in this really interesting homoerotic way by these two cops. And it's funny. It is funny. But at the same time, that film I don't think focuses nearly as much on sexual activity as it does on sexual anticipation. And I think a film like American Pie from 7 years ago already, or actually 8 years ago already, it focused more on sexual activity and on how young men need to learn something about sex before they actually get involved with it. I found Superbad not nearly as graphic or confrontational as I'd expected.
What were your thoughts on the film?
Well, I certainly laughed a lot. I laughed a lot at how these three young male characters bumbled and stumbled, and that's engaging. I think it's quite curious that the film makes the only two prominent adult characters police officers, and by adults, they're supposedly in their mid to late 20s. There's very little evidence of parents in the film, and the young people exist in this utopian world of all youth around the high school and around having a party, and it's a very standard plot in that way, the big party film where everything is going to culminate on the night of the big party. And there I felt a little bit disappointed, because while I thought that there's the sort of horny teenager played by the character Seth, there's the more good guy, sincere character, Evan, and then there's the oddball, McLovin, who's really quite funny, but none of them have really had a great revelation. The last scene in the film suggests that they've all learned something, but the film ends on a really kind of empty note, saying that it's not sure where they're going to go, and that, to me, felt like they hadn't learned that much after all, that it was still very tenuous. And I guess for a Hollywood film, I want something a little bit more assured. I couldn't help but think of Knocked Up, because Seth Rogen's in both films, because he co-wrote this film. And Knocked Up ends with a somewhat Hollywood ending of him and his girlfriend going off with a baby, and they're going to somehow live happily ever after. And still I felt that was closure. I don't think Superbad can end with any kind of closure, and I don't know if it's because they didn't know how to end the film or if they simply wanted to leave it open for a sequel. That's absolutely possible.
Well, I mean, there's certainly the cementing of the friendship between two of the three characters at the end. And I think also, but you don't think the characters, I mean, they learn that, hey, you know, it's not incredibly wise to just leap into sex, that you should think about forming relationships with these girls. I think you kind of get that at the end.
You're right. In that way, I think it fits the perspective of be more cautious, because these young men realize that they, well, for instance, Evan, and I don't want to spoil the entire ending of the film for your viewers, but Evan has a moment, he has an opportunity with a character named Becca, and he has to say to himself, well, you know, is this the right time? And you know where he's going to fall. He's, of course, going to be the good guy. Seth has his opportunity, and he kind of stumbles in his own way. And McLovin, he doesn't, again, he doesn't quite get the opportunity because he's interrupted by the two cops. I think the film ultimately wants to play the kind of ego, id, and super ego, you know, triad, the varieties of youth sexual experience, and yet it doesn't know quite where it wants to stand. I just think it wants to explore those possibilities, and in the end, I don't think it's all that radical.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and today I'm joined by Tim Sherry, who is the Director of Film and Video Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And we're talking about American teenagers in cinema, and that we're just talking about Superbad. And you commented on how there's very much a lack of parental authority, a lack of adult figures in the film, with the exception of the cops. But of course, the cops are basically overgrown kids, you know, it seems. Have there been any major teen films in the past where adults were a large component of the storyline? You know, I mean, I'm thinking of like films like Ferris Bueller, or, I mean, certainly Say Anything, if there was some adult involvement there. But I think in most of these films, that probably was the case, right? Or am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. Quite often, these teen films are made so that teens feel they have a utopian world of their own. It's all youth. Parents are gone for the weekend or for a week. Risky Business certainly capitalized on that theme. In Say Anything, it was different because the father of Yoni Sky,
John Mahoney, I believe, right?
Yeah, John Mahoney, exactly, who later gained greater visibility on Frasier. But I would say that when you really look at the 80s, the parental presence is quite minimal in most of those films. The teenagers seem to be living on their own. These are films making statements about latchkey kids, about the effects of divorce, about the impact of step-parents having to pick them up, drop them off, and deal with them. And that hasn't changed all that much. I think the way that the studios have dealt with those kinds of storylines is simply by assuming that kids know parents aren't all that important anymore. And that's somewhat dangerous. Being a parent myself, I can tell you, you know, I think a lot of young people who are parents today fear that that's the way their kids will view them over time, as irrelevant, as inconsequential and inconspicuous. And the films overall tend to view parents that way. So that, I think, certainly has been quite prominent since the 80s. It was not that way in most films going back to the 50s and 60s. Parents were very present. If anything, they were overbearing, they were repressive or oppressive, and they really had a prominent role in the lives of their children. By nowadays, it seems like they just make a cameo appearance.
One film that I'm thinking of in terms of adult involvement, and it was a dark comedy called Election that was directed by Alexander Payne. Came out around 2000 and had Matthew Broderick and also Reese Witherspoon. And there was very much teacher versus student conflict. Yep. And Reese Witherspoon plays this very, very type A personality who's running for president of student council. Matthew Broderick is a teacher who's trying to do everything in his power to stop her. And very much a dark comedy. And do you think that qualifies as a teen film or not so much? Or what do we really look for here?
Well, people ask all the time, what is a teen film? And my definition has always been, is it a film that focuses on teenage characters?
Okay.
That doesn't mean, is it made for teenagers? Because the fact of the matter is, the great majority of Hollywood films are made for young people. The demographic shows that somewhere between 15 and 30 is the highest proportion of people that go to the movies. So, of course, Hollywood goes for its demographic market. this is one of the reasons why Hollywood, at the same time, doesn't make that many movies about the elderly. Even though the elderly represent a very high proportion of our population now, they don't go to the movies that much. So they don't make that many movies about the elderly that are going to be shown theatrically. Teenagers go to the movies, college students and young people go to the movies, and they make movies that are appealing to them. So when I get into the argument of where does a teen movie begin or end, it's with the characters, and I would say that Election certainly qualifies. It revolves around a teacher who's at least in his 30s, but it's also very much about three or four other teenage characters who are going through what they feel are relatively, you know, significant moments in their lives. And it's dark, and it's very crafty, and I think really well done. I thought Election was one of the great teen films of the 90s. It was just at the end of the 90s. And for that matter, I thought around the same time, American Pie and Coming Soon were both really great movies, but Coming Soon was overshadowed by American Pie because the sexual content of the latter was about of Coming Soon was about girls, and American Pie was mostly about boys. So it's remarkable how the industry still is influenced by traditional standards of young male interests.
Other teen films that are interesting to look at. We had O and also Romeo and Juliet, O standing for Othello, and both stories done over in it very much a teen motif. I know Othello took place in a high school.
Yes.
Romeo and Juliet had more of a gang warfare type of...
Yes, and that was able to play out in a very stylistic way with Baz Luhrmann, the Australian director, having his stylized slow motion and saturated color effects, and it worked, I thought, in a way that was quite stimulating, but a lot of purists of Shakespeare, of course, thought it was a really rather base interpretation of the bard there at the end of the century. Still, that was 96, and it was long before Columbine. O was meant to come out in 99, the year of Columbine, and it dealt with teenage crime in a school, and it was held up for about a year and a half to 2 years. And that, I think, more than anything, is revelatory of how the industry is so sensitive to the issues of the culture at large. If the industry really was sensitive to, say, racial tensions in the 90s, and they thought that they would lose money by releasing films about that subject, they would have never released Boys in the Hood or Juice or Menace to Society. But they saw that those films would make money, and they did. Now they know that if they make films about teenage criminality, teenage killers, teenage sexual abuse, those films are going to be incredibly controversial, and they pretty much avoid them altogether. Even though those issues are still very relevant, they just avoid them altogether.
Well, one of my favorite films that I've seen in the last 2 years is a film called Brick. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Fantastic film. It's really film noir set in a high school where drug use and violence really is a major component of the story.
You're right. And I couldn't help but think one of the reasons it didn't get more attention was because it dealt with drug use and teen violence in such a frank way. It is highly stylized. It's clearly meant to be some kind of homage to the noir style. And it doesn't have a very big name cast, but then neither did a lot of films like American Pie when they were first made. I just don't think that those kinds of films are likely to make it in the mainstream teen market without a lot of support from their studios and from their promotion companies that are willing to take chances and say to young people, take a look at this. Those kinds of films do often much more business on the secondary market, that is DVD. Napoleon Dynamite is a great example of that. I don't think that film was easily marketable when it was in theatrical release. It made very little in movie theaters. On DVD, it made, I think, over $50 million. And it became a cult hit, as they like to say, because young people attached to it. They found it quirky. It was certainly not very violent, not very sexual. It just had a charm to it that young people really enjoyed. And at the theatrical level, I don't think they knew how to promote it.
A short while back during our conversation, we were talking about horror films, and you mentioned how horror films in the 70s were a major component of the teen film. And A while ago, I did a show on Hollywood remakes, and it seems like horror films are just the biggest targets for remakes. We've already had The Hitcher come out earlier this year. We had The Hills Have Eyes that was remade. They're also coming out with another version of Halloween, a remake of that in a couple of weeks. Yeah, today, actually. You're right. You're right. We can remake these horror movies all the time, and you know, no one would protest. Or at least not too loudly. It seems like that's a very common occurrence. But could we remake a movie like Say Anything or like Ferris Bueller?
Well, there's some reasons why horror movies are easier to remake than, say, a teen sex comedy or teen romantic drama. And one of the biggest reasons is that horror doesn't date the same way. You know, horror is always horrific. It's always bloody and scary, and things that scare us, that is, the dark, monsters, killers, fear of death, they've been the same for thousands of years. Whereas, while we all have wanted love and sex for that same length of time, the fact is the nuances of those practices have changed quite a bit. And so dating in the 70s and 80s is absolutely not the same as it is today. The music has changed, the fashion has changed, and young people are very sensitive to that. No generation of young people wants to be associated with a generation before or after. They all want to feel distinct. And so the teenagers of 2007 do not want to look at all at the teenagers of 2002. And in 5 years from now, the teenagers of 2012 will be actively resisting the teenagers of 2007. And you can look back to the 80s, 90s, 70s, and you see how disco was so vehemently rejected by young people of the 80s, for instance, because it was so 70s. And the fact of the matter was, what teenagers of the early 80s got involved with wasn't all that different in many ways. And we haven't seen, in my opinion, a truly radical departure since the 50s. That's when teenagers began rejecting the softer look of young people in schools. They began wearing jeans. They began wearing leather jackets. They began smoking more. They began driving more. They had so much more disposable income and access to what were previously adult practices because of the post-war baby boom. And that led, of course, to the rebellion of the 60s. But I don't think teenagers have changed that much in their styles. I just think that they're very conscious of the nuances in those styles and in their, say, figures of speech, in their mating rituals and so on. They're very attuned to that. So I feel for screenwriters to this day that try to capture the teen lexicon, because it could change from 1 week to the next, or at least 1 month to the next.
Well, I know Cameron Crowe, wasn't that the idea behind Fast Times at Ridgemont High? I believe he actually spent a year posing as a student, and then he wrote the book, which turned into the film.
If not a year, it was at least some time.
Okay.
And apparently he was able to infiltrate the school system and go in and gather some what now seem like really rather truthful facts around young people, because it is true that at least in the 80s, up to 1 in 10 teenage girls were getting pregnant. Now those statistics are lower, which I think overall is good. But back then also, in Fast Times, a teenage girl went to an abortion clinic and got an abortion in a safe clinic, and now that's not dealt with in film at all. I can't think of a single film since 1990, a single teen film at least, that's actually featured a teenager having an abortion. The one that is an exception is Coach Carter from a few years ago, where a teenager has an abortion, but it's just simply elided off screen. She says, well, I took care of that. But it's been a long time since it's been safe for teenage girls who get pregnant to go and have abortions. And, of course, teenage pregnancy happens very rarely in teen movies. Sexual diseases happen very rarely. And teenagers themselves very rarely are asked to confront what they're going to do for a job or how they're going to be after college. That's why they go to see these movies. It's a great fantasy. It's a great, wondrous escape for them to think, oh, it's the last week or last night, it's prom night, how am I going to celebrate my teen years before I have to become an adult? And there's no other genre that looks at life the same way.
For Tim Sherry, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you can hear part two of our conversation in 2 weeks on September 26th. And for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org.
Tardiness is not something you can do all on your own. Many, many people contributed to my tardiness. I'd like to thank my parents for never giving me a ride to school, the L.A. City bus driver for taking a chance on an unknown kid, and last but not least, the wonderful crew at McDonald's for spending hours making those Egg McMuffins, without which I might never be tardy.